the root of the problem is that the money, how money is created and how it's distributed throughout the economy. It has externalities on everything. Bitcoin can be a means to an end, but it's how do you convince people that this is the right means to the right end?
If you own Bitcoin and you have it self-custodied, it's yours. It's going to be your way out of this dystopian hellhole that's probably going to get produced. The point of uncensorable cypherpunk money is to be uncensorable and allow for anyone anywhere to use it for whatever they want. If you're worried about the state doing stuff, like, get the fuck out of, like, I don't know what you're doing here. I don't understand why you're interested in this project.
You should just kind of bluntly assume your favorite Bitcoin developer is probably an intelligence asset just because that's the model. If you're a Bitcoiner who believes in freedom, like, you have to tread lightly as you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, because you are beset on all sides by enemies.
Eric, Hoddle, Marty, good to see you guys. I wanted to get a show out for Bitcoin White Paper Day. 17 years since the white paper dropped. This is going to go out on Friday. Marty, this is your first time on the show, though. Welcome, man.
It's great to be here. I was on the previous iteration of what Bitcoin did, but never this one.
Yeah, we tried to make it work in Austin when I was there a few months ago, but here we are anyway. But 17 years since the white paper dropped. You guys have all been in Bitcoin for like a long time. Eric, I think probably you've been in the longest. I just want to get a bit of a reflection on this. Like, when you look back at what Bitcoin's done over the last 17 years, like, how do you take it in? It's gone from being like worth literally zero. You could get it free, like on faucets, and you could mine it on your home laptop, to being like a $2 trillion asset that's very sort of geopolitically relevant. Like, how do you take all that in?
Yeah, I remember when you used to be able to get like a hundredth of a Bitcoin from a faucet. I mean, it's like I took acid and it never wore off. It's just like I'm like perpetually in this insane trip of a journey. And like, it's super blessed and amazing. I mean, when I first discovered Bitcoin, there was very little outside of the Bitcoin talk forms that were available. Yeah, and it was like a batshit crazy idea. And it's funny because like, I don't feel like there's as much of the like, you smoked the Bitcoin crack sort of effect that like people used to have. Because like, some of the other early psychopaths that I met, like they would be like, yeah, like when it clicked for me, like I couldn't sleep for days on end. I like lost a bunch of weight. It was, you know, like I really got what it was. And so now that it's like actually achieving what it set out to be, it's a very strange and ethereal journey. But I feel immensely blessed that I saw what it was, that it seems to be doing what we wanted to. And we're also at this very interesting inflection point where it seems like Banker Bitcoin and Suitcoin is actually giving like cypherpunk vision a bit of a run for its money at this point in time. So I don't know, like I feel really great about what it's accomplished, but I'm deeply concerned about the lack of pedagogical approach about like the point of uncensorable cypherpunk money is to be uncensorable and allow for anyone anywhere to use it for whatever they want. And like that's its technical purpose. And so seeing a lot of people just cheering on number go up repeatedly, I do find a bit alarming. But with that being said, Bitcoin's magnitude's beyond anything I could have imagined in my wildest dreams. So like, I feel deeply blessed that the vision is out there in the world and it offers a radical new kind of hope to most people. I'd just like to get back to sort of a lot of the insane stuff that me and Hoddle first connected around, like in sort of the 2020, 2021 cycle, where it was much more about like, you know, the spiritual awakening of Bitcoin, as opposed to that we're all just going to get rich and drive Ferraris.
Do you think that's just like a consequence of scale, though, and not everyone's going to get Bitcoin in that way? Because like, I'm with you. I got into Bitcoin later than you, but even when I did, like from the day I first heard about Bitcoin, there's probably not been a single day since that I've not read about it, like tried to learn about it, want to go further and further down that rabbit hole. But like, as this scales, not everyone's going to be like that.
Yeah, and I do think that's part of the consequence. I also think that like sort of the crazier, more radical voices are getting drowned out a bit. And like, I sort of think it's time for us to redouble into our own insane journey. Because like, my deepest frustration now when I talk to people, I'm like, oh, I'm a Bitcoiner. They're like, oh, crypto. And I'm like, no, if you ever say that again, I'm going to smack it right out of your fucking mouth. And I'm very pedantic. I'm like, if you don't understand the difference between Bitcoin and crypto, you don't understand either. And you're going to get scammed for the latter, as opposed to actually getting the true cause of what the former is. And like, it's that Bitcoin has a real opportunity to free us from the endemic rot that like is the fiat system. And I drive people around me crazy by like constantly commenting on the societal ills that fiat has created. And you can just see that metastasizing effect across society. And at this point in America, like I highly expect in the next 5 years, it's fascism or communism. It's like one of the two choices. And that's just a result of a broken money system. And it's really interesting to like watch America become like the Wiemeyer remix of like 2030s, you know, and like that's what we're going to get. And it's pretty scary because also like the communists have like a very strong argument now of like, yeah, fuck it. Like, let's just seize the boomers' property, redistribute it to the youth because like they fucked us over. We'll never fucking touch Social Security. We'll never get entitlements. They're just handing out willy-nilly Medicare to everyone except for the youth. So yeah, like, fuck it. Let's just have a full-on communist party, start seizing wealth across the board, start executing VCs. It'll work great. Uh-huh. And at that point, that's when you get somebody in the far right being like, hey, they're going to kill all you guys if you don't give me radical power. So you can either sign up here or get executed by the communists. Which one?
This is funny you're bringing this up because this aligns very much in my early Bitcoin story back in like 2013. I got pushed over the edge. I was like really into Bitcoin. It's funny. This is the Philadelphia Inquirer headline from October 31st, 2008, when the white paper dropped. Why we're here to meet this. I was 17 years old, running around the streets of Philadelphia after the Phillies won the World Series. Great financial crisis was happening. I went to college with a know your enemy mentality. But to your point, Eric, what really pushed me over the edge is I worked for this Russian immigrant. He immigrated to the United States in the 90s. And I'll never forget this one portfolio management meeting we had. We sat down and ended up just being me and him. His name was Dimitri. In the room, we were talking about TSA and civil liberties and stuff like that. And he typically, during our meetings, he would just look at his computer. He was a quant and he'd have all this stuff up. And he like turned from his computer and looked at me. When we were talking about the TSA, he was like, Marty, I want to tell you a story. The first time I immigrated here, I'll never forget in 1994, the first time I walked through an airport in the United States, I cried because I never felt that amount of freedom. And I want to warn you, as a young 22-year-old man, that the U.S. is turning into the Soviet Russia I ran away from. And that was in like 2013, maybe early 2014. And I was learning about Bitcoin at the time, but just reflecting on America, not necessarily Bitcoin since then. Like, yeah, it's definitely gone down that trajectory towards overt communism. And really why I went full bore into Bitcoin in the first place was like, this thing is separate from that. I need to focus my attention on this.
Yeah. Just reflecting on the whole thing. Like, I remember, you know, being deeply affected by the great financial crisis, just like Marty. I have a friend, Jensith, who says that you didn't get to Bitcoin because you're so smart. You got here because you were a young man who had stupid ideas about the government, which I certainly embodied. I was, you know, in high school writing papers about like seasteading and things like that. And my daughter's walking through. Hi, sweetie. Can you go? Thank you. I was ideologically predisposed to be a crazy libertarian person. And then you find Bitcoin and you're like, well, shit, here it is. The thing we've been waiting for. Like, we don't have to be loser libertarians anymore. We can be rich libertarians who like, you know, affect the world in a positive way and actually like maybe, you know, maybe we can get towards anarcho-capitalism because Bitcoin is solving a problem, right? It's not just us complaining or doing rhetoric against the system. Like, we actually are solving a problem. And the problem is, like, you know, people used to say in the early days of Bitcoin, it had no killer app. And it's like, the killer app is prosperity. You know, prosperity is the killer app. And every single person on earth wants that. And when you talk about this political fight that's happening now between the commies and, you know, the fascists, and I was just listening to like Fuentes on Tucker Carlson, and he throws in there as this like sort of casual aside that he admires Joseph Stalin.
Yeah,
and it's like,
weird.
And it just gets brushed right by. And it's like, okay, both of these guys, the Luigi Mangione left, the Groypers, everyone's an economic populist, and economic populism is rising. And I think that we as the Bitcoiners are like, which is weird because we're the people who are from the island of misfit toys. We're the weirdos. We are now occupying the sane, like, middle ground. Like, we are the rational center and saying, hey, guys, like, maybe it's not we need to kill all the immigrants, and maybe it's not we need to kill everybody with more than $1 million. Maybe it's We need a money that can't be corrupted. And oh, by the way, we're a broad, multi-diverse, multi-racial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious coalition of young people who have all seen a better, brighter, oranger future and like, join us, you know? And that's crazy, but it gets less crazy every day. Less, you know, the alternative, like the mainstream political alternatives are so much fucking crazier than what I just said. Like, magic internet money, join us. You know what I mean? A man in a stupid wizard hat. Like, that's way more sane than what's going on the left or the right.
What Bitcoin Did is brought to you by the massive legends, Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they're also providing cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. We've been working with their founders, Dan and Will, for quite some time now and have been really impressed with their values, especially their commitment to local communities and sustainable computing power. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com. If you already self-custody your Bitcoin, you know the deal with hardware wallets. Complex setups, clumsy interfaces, and a seed phrase that can be lost, stolen, or forgotten. Well, BitKey fixes that. BitKey is a multi-sig hardware wallet built by the team behind Square and Cash App. It packs a cryptographic recovery system and built-in inheritance feature into an intuitive, easy-to-use wallet with no seed phrase to sweat over. It's simple, secure self-custody without the stress. And Time named BitKey one of the best inventions of 2024. Get 20% off at bitkey.world when you use the code WBD. That's bitkey.world and use the code WBD. This episode is brought to you by AnchorWatch. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. And this is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, your Bitcoin is insured with your own A-plus rated Lloyd's of London insurance policy, and all Bitcoin is held in their time-locked multi-sig vaults. So you have the peace of mind knowing your Bitcoin is insured while not giving up custody. So whether you're worried about inheritance planning, rent tax, natural disasters, or just your own silly mistakes, you're protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit anchorwatch.com today. That is anchorwatch.com. Marty, I want to go back to something you said before. Like, you were talking about the US basically trending towards Soviet Russia. If that's happening, the UK and Australia and other places around the world are definitely front-running the US in that sense. Do you think Bitcoin can actually stop that? Or is Bitcoin just an opt-out so you don't have to be involved in it?
I don't think Bitcoin in and of itself can really stop anything. It's really up to individuals adopting Bitcoin and using it to stop it. And I think, obviously, the four of us here are pretty much well on our way to trying to do that. I think, HODL, to your point, and I think it's the one thing I've been reflecting on a lot in the last year is, okay, like, how can we sharpen the messaging to really get through to people? Like you're saying, we have the crazy left and the crazy right, and they're all somehow missing that there's a third option or another option. Maybe there's more than three with Bitcoin, where the root of the problem is that the money, how money's created and how it's distributed throughout the economy. It has externalities on everything we touch in the economy. And so, like, Bitcoin can be a means to an end, but it's how do you convince people that this is the right means to the right end? And that's something that I think a lot about these days.
And HODL, like, you were saying that prosperity is the killer app, like, and that kind of goes against what Eric was saying, because you're basically saying number go up is the thing we need right now, so Bitcoiners get wealthy and can, I guess, change the world themselves. Do you think we are sacrificing things for number go up right now?
Yeah, there's a tension. I mean, listen, just to be honest, yeah, there's a tension between censorship resistance and number go up. And I've long had this sort of view that Bitcoin is going to have to walk through sort of a period of, like, you know, purgatory, essentially, like, that there's going to be like a shadow, you know, co-option of Bitcoin, where it kind of looks like Bitcoin has been cucked, and then Bitcoin explodes out the other side. Now, maybe that's like a defeatist viewpoint and people are like, oh, you can't give in, because, you know, but I think that if you're thinking about these things as two super organisms, like Bitcoin and the traditional financial system, I think Bitcoin is a pathogen that eats the host. And so I think if we put Bitcoin into the traditional financial system, I think it will overtake the traditional financial system over time. And I don't know that the idea of Bitcoin being outside money is Bitcoin's ultimate destiny, because in order to get where it's going, it has to pass through the traditional system, I think. So like, you see this throughout history, like, you know, Christianity subsumes Rome, and I think Bitcoin subsumes like the modern state, the fiat state. And that's a long, arduous journey that, like, if you're a Bitcoiner who believes in freedom, like, you have to tread lightly as you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, because you are beset on all sides by enemies. You know, that's just the way it is. We've chosen the hardest path on the table, basically. It's a lot easier to join up and say, I'm going to be a far right populist, or I'm going to be a far left populist. You know, Bitcoiners are trying to walk the middle path, and it's difficult.
Yeah, I want to know what you think about that, Eric, because like with the way Bitcoin, people interact with Bitcoin now, it's like KYC, AML exchanges, there's like treasury companies, ETFs, the institutionalization of Bitcoin. Like that is the area that I have like some, not a great deal of concern in, but like some degree of concern in. Like, do you think Bitcoin's strong enough to go through that and make out the other side, like Hoddle's saying, or do you think we risk losing something along the way?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because like I feel like this is always the game Bitcoin's playing with, the Trojan horse thing. And so like I feel like we're at the place where like they've brought in the horse into Troy. They've all had their great celebration. And I think like now we essentially need to see a bunch of shit blow up internally inside of the financial system and watch kind of the general wealthy and elite flee to Bitcoin. And that's sort of them like opening the gates of Troy and fleeing. And then it's like, oh, look, the Aegeans are outside. With that being said, maybe like this is more onto us, as I felt back in like the 2021 era, I felt like we had a really strong narrative about how Bitcoin was going to fuck up this system and empower people. But really, like, I kind of think like stealing from Lenin's playbook, like we essentially need a deep class consciousness awakening, and there needs to be a pedagogical approach that explains how fiat money has destroyed society. Because I find it very interesting that everyone sees how absolutely fucked up everything is, and usually they take a right-left paradigm in order to describe that. And like, particularly being here in like the liberal hub of the world, like I'm extremely pedantic with my liberal friends about like, you like, we have this like no kings bullshit going on here about like Trump trying to like do gerrymandering. And I'm just like, how, like, come on, God, like how much of a bozo do you have to be to see that like they're doing gerrymandering for the left, and that somebody like Nancy Pelosi is now worth $100 million despite being a career politician? Like, you don't think that that is from pure and utter corruption, and that like at least people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are being direct about how they want to make money. Like, Nancy Pelosi is a pure parasite insofar of that she literally engages in insider trading, robs the American public by making backdoor deals with some of the most disgusting people and ideas that there could be. And yet somehow you find yourself cheering for her and her side. You really need to look deeper into what's going on if you actually want to liberate yourself. And I have a great answer for you, but it's going to require some real thought on your part and really actually wondering whether or not you've become a useful idiot for people that hate you and want to abuse you and steal from you. Because I do have an answer, but it's going to require you to do some real thought and actually start in the process of unwinding the very deep brainwashing that most people have gone through. And some people receive it, some people don't. But at the end of the day, like, and this is why I've kind of lightly flirted with the idea about an orange party, is that like, my idea is we essentially need a radical central orange party that's in the middle that advocates for these very middle of the road normal things, and in the process needs to absolutely fucking lambast anybody on the right or left and be like, the Democrats and the Republicans are the enemies. They've destroyed our fucking country. And when we come to power, every single federal representative will be put on trial for treason. And when they're found guilty, they will be hung according to American law. Because that's what they did. They engaged in outright fucking treason. They never expected themselves to be held accountable. And I want to see them hung from public gallows when it becomes very clear that they sold us up the street to the Chinese for like, what, $20,000 maybe? Like, that's the other thing that's outrageous, is the amount of money that they're prostituting us for is fucking pennies on the dollar. And with that being said, this establishment is so corrupt, I don't see why we can't just ram through state legislatures. Because what, to buy something to pass any state legislature, it's going to cost maybe $50,000 to get converts on the right side. And as you popularize a movement like this, you just strong arm everybody, because it's clear that these geriatrics are completely spineless individuals, that the moment that you start putting real pressure on them and being very clear that this is the direction it's going, and this isn't about money anymore, this is actually about whether or not they're going to live at the end of this, yeah, they'll collapse. But again, this is a very radical viewpoint that I'm establishing. So if anybody wants to take this and run with it, please feel free.
I don't think it needed that disclaimer. But what kind of legislation do you want to push through? Like, because you're the anarchist, like, why do you want this to go through sort of the government rails?
Excellent question. I wanted to go through state government rails, because in the United States, we have the ability to amend the Constitution using state legislations alone. There's been a number of amendments to the U.S. Constitution that have gotten pretty close. And I'm pretty sure the only amendment that was actually pushed through this methodology was to repeal the amendment for prohibition. And so essentially the idea is that if you can get 35 state legislatures to pass an amendment to the United States Constitution using the slang language, that's supposed to just be added to the Constitution directly and unilaterally. And this was explicitly explained in the Federalist Papers as a way for the American public to be able to reclaim their republic when the federal government has become entirely corrupt, mm-hmm. which I think that's the place that we're at. And so it's a radically different strategy that sort of tries to lateralize states to reclaim their ability to essentially prove their sovereignty through amending the Constitution without any sort of federal representatives whatsoever. Again, this is like kind of a harebrained idea. I don't really want to run this down because, like, I'm not a politician and I don't really want to get shot at this age. Although, maybe I'm due for a young death anyway. So, like, maybe we should just run this down anyways. So,
but what do you want added to the Constitution?
First one is just like unilateral destruction of the Federal Reserve. Just like the Federal Reserve does not get to issue the dollar anymore. Done. And like with that, it's amended the Constitution. And the interesting thing is, like, this causes a constitutional crisis, because it's not like the federal government's just going to be like, oh, no, they amended the Constitution with Article 5. Like, gee golly dang. You know, in addition to, like, if you get that method to work, keep going. It's like, you know, the United States federal government has no right to tax anyone anymore. Or, like, the IRS is just an illegal institution that needs to be outright liquidated today. Like, you know, let your mind go crazy, because there's no reason why we can't just use amendments directly as a way to essentially have a plebiscite to be able to pass laws against the federal government. And again, super radical idea, would definitely cause a constitutional crisis, would probably get me killed in the process, but fuck it. We're all going to die at this point in time if communism comes along. So I'd rather get shot than starved to death.
I love that. Whenever you speak to Eric, this is about, like, reflecting on 17 years of Bitcoin. It took us, what, 20 minutes to get into hanging all the politicians.
Well, look, I want to only do it if they've actually been found guilty of treason. All I'm saying is, let's actually uphold the laws that have been established.
There will be due process.
I think if we looked in the...
It's not French Revolution. Yeah. It's due process.
Exactly. And it's very important that state governments all handle this on their own. So I'd expect that the representatives of each individual state, in addition to their senators, you know, so I would want Wyoming to put their senators on trial. And if it turns out that their senators hadn't broken the law, excellent. They don't get hung. Turns out that if, you know, some of the representatives in California that took COVID money and never paid it back had broke the law, well, hey, that they need to be held accountable for. But to me, like, again, and it is ironic that as the anarchist, that, like, I'm the one representing the rule of law more than anybody else, is just kind of the irony of the entirety of this thing. The very fact that we're talking about magic internet money is supposed to be the thing that returns us to sane economic prerogatives in the world is, well, that's where we're at in the narrative. So here we are.
You brought up the No Kings protest. I've very intentionally just ignored everything that's been going on with that, because yeah. I don't need to pay attention to that. But can one of you fill me in? Like, how big has that been over there?
Not that big.
It's yeah. It seems like it's astroturfed, honestly. Like, it yeah. seems kind of fake. You know?
Yeah. It's,
I've seen some people hanging out at, like, again, because I live in, like, the heart of liberal Mecca. Like, I see some people standing out on the corners with their signs congratulating themselves for participating in democracy, but I'm just, like, super confused, because, like, wasn't Donald Trump, like, elected through the democratic process? So, and, like, furthermore, like, I don't know of a lot of kings that, like, served for one term and then, like, left afterwards and re-elected. And so I don't know. There's like a weird brain virus going on because like, I don't actually hear, I mean, like of the two Republicans that I know in the area, like they don't talk about Trump incessantly. Whereas like the liberals that I know, they're always like, that piece of shit, Trump, and he's destroying America with his fascism. And I'm like, do you know what this word means? Because like, I think you're using a lot of words that you don't understand. They're like, yeah, like fascism's where the bad guy wins. And I'm like, no, I think that there's maybe a deeper concept. Because I always insist to people, like, the problem with calling Trump a fascist, like, he's not principled enough to be a fascist. Like, if he was a fascist, like, I'm pretty sure we'd see a lot more people in prison and getting murdered extrajudicially. So, I don't know. That's just my standpoint with it. But, yeah, I do feel like this is astroturfed. And it's, I don't know, this is all bullshit. It's this left-right thing to divide us instead of us be like, hey, like, the cost of groceries has gone up 50% in the last 5 years. Like, that seems to be fucking all of us pretty equally, except for this political class. That's pretty strange, huh?
Just to bring it back to Bitcoin for a minute. We've done 965 shows or something about all the wins that Bitcoin has had. But is there anything that you think we're not doing well enough? Maybe we'll start with you, Marty.
Getting to the youth. I was going to say, Eric, while you're talking about that, like, not only are we stuck in the middle with you with red and blue, but I think it's like boomers and Gen Z. It's like, I feel like there's a cohort of millennials. Obviously, not every millennial is in the Bitcoin, but I think we're overrepresented within people that have adopted Bitcoin. And the boomers are just old dogs. You're not going to teach an old dog new trick. And then the Zoomers are just completely nihilistic and running towards the wrong fake idols, if you will. And it's like, how do we, that's one thing again I've been thinking about. And we had a whole Zoomer series on RHR earlier.
I remember
this year.
When I was in Austin early this year, Marty, we were talking about this because like, I think the demographics for our shows are probably pretty similar. Like the boomers, I've actually seen that growing. Like I do see a sort of growing cohort there, but in terms of sort of Gen Z, it's almost no one listens to the show. I don't know whether that's because it's like long form content, people prefer different types of media, but like, how do you reach those people?
I don't know. I'm looking at my demo right now. Core demo is 35 to 44 at 25%. The next is 45 to 54 at 24. And then it's 55 to 64. And then it's 65 plus, and then it drops down to 25, 34. So it's not even millennials in my age, which is crazy. I don't know if it's the type of content we do, but I'm sure yours is similar for some reason.
Yeah, it is.
The Zoomers, who are arguably the most important cohort for us to go out and convert to recognizing this third way of doing things, are just not getting this information from what I can tell.
I do wonder though, like, because when I got into Bitcoin, I didn't have very much money at all, but and Bitcoin seemed expensive then, and like relatively, it was obviously not. Like, do you think that's just unit bias? They're like, how can I, you know, gain from this thing when I can just go and like punt on meme stocks or whatever?
I think we're just living in a completely different world. I've come to realize this like in the last 3 years. Like, I don't get Zoomer culture at all.
Like, no, I get that.
Meme 6-7 or something like that. That I feel
6-7.
It's the first time I have no idea what it is, and apparently it's the biggest thing.
And yeah, I've never even heard of that.
Me neither.
I think the thing that's hard as a millennial to understand about Zoomers is that just how pronounced the nihilism is. I think like we all go on Twitter and we're like, oh my God, things are just getting worse every day. But we still have this sort of inherent like boomer utopianism because we were like, or optimism because we were raised by the boomers. And so we kind of think that, I don't know, things are pretty shit, but like, I think we can pull it out. Like maybe we can make it work, you know? And so Bitcoin is a, you know, it's a philosophy of rational optimism because you're basically saying like, I have a future and I'm going to like plan for my future. And I'm going to do that with Bitcoin. But if you've totally swallowed the black pill, then, you know, you're basically saying like, I'm waiting for the revolution. And if the revolution never comes, I'll just kill myself, you know? And I think unfortunately that's what's going on with a lot of people in the Gen Z demographic. And what I would say to them is basically like, listen, the generational divide, whatever, millennials are cringe. Yeah, of course we're cringe. That's our thing, dog. You guys need to care about yourself and you need to like start making some plans because you do have a future. No matter what happens, the world gets really bad, the world goes dark, whatever. It's like, the sun is still going to come up and people are still going to go to work and people are still going to raise their families. Like, you have a future. And so you need to plan accordingly as if you have a future. And you need to do that in a rationally optimistic way, you know, I think with Bitcoin. But like in all aspects of your life, you should plan that you're going to be here in the next 10 years, because the people that aren't, that don't plan to be here, they end up in woeful circumstances. They're still here. They don't die. They're still here 10, 20, 30 years from now. And they end up in just these awful circumstances with just these miserable lives. And you don't want that to be you.
I mean, to be fair, to like Steelman, the black pill argument, like it's like really strong. It kind of reminds me of like the fish parable, but with darkness. It's like, hey, kids, like, how's the light today? And like, you know, the fish swims back. They're like, what's light? You know, because like look at the demographics and the statistics that like they grew up with a generation of parents who like already believed like the climate crisis doomerism. AI doomerism, like, I'm in the heart of AI. Like, it's fucking bananas that, like, I don't think I've met a single person. Well, there's one guy, but outside of him, I don't think I've met a single AI person that, like, has a non-black-pilled version. So, like, AI is going to murder everybody anyways. Like, the politics are completely fucked across the board. The idea of them living, moving out of their parents' basement is a distant dream. You know, the idea of just getting a room in the house and not living in the basement is, like, a dream. So, like, they have a pretty strong argument for, like, why should I give a fuck about myself or the future? Because it's not going to come. And this is one of the places where, like, that's why I think that, like, insane communism works. Because it's like, hey, if you join my communist party, we're just going to kill the boomers and steal their shit and redistribute their housing to you. So would you like to take up arms for the great communist cause? I'm like, that's like a pretty appealing thing at this point in time. And it's fucking terrifying. And I wish that this would actually get the boomers to the table in a meaningful way to go, oh, yeah, we did actually fuck everything up, rewarded ourselves, and then sold our children down the river. And now our grandchildren are going to murder us for that. You know, like that seems to be like a probabilistical outcome. And the thing that I find deeply resentful of is that, like, when, at least in my case, when this has been presented to boomers, you kind of just get a shrug. And they're kind of like, eh.
I'm 10 feet away from the grave anyway. Like, don't care.
Yeah. And so, like, in all honesty, like, again, I think this brings it back to us and our demographic. And, like, it kind of sucks to admit it. But, like, I think we just have to actually do something, even though I'm, like, pretty resistant to it. And, like, this is absolutely idiotic that it's, like, magic internet money is here to save everybody from the nihilistic hellhole that the world is becoming. But this seems to be the narrative that we're on the course for. So I guess let's just get it done before it gets fucking harder.
I do think, like, when you talk about we're going to move to either communism or fascism, like, the communist outcome is really easy to predict, especially with AI. Like, you can see UBI is almost like baked in the cake at this point to me. Like, I don't understand how we can have anything else. Do you think that's the most likely outcome here?
No, I think the fascist outcome is the most likely outcome.
Why? Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, because the surveillance state has already been built. And it works whether you're a communist, oligarchy or a fascist dictator. And I think that the call to, you know, restoring Western society to what it once was, because, you know, many of the people alive have seen it deteriorate, I think is going to be a pretty strong call. And all you need is a charismatic, you know, dictator type to come and say he's going to fix everything. And a lot of people who are otherwise normal, hardworking, conservative, you know, family people will have this, the opposite brainworm of the communist brainworm, and say to themselves, well, I do want things to go back to normal. So let's grant this guy unlimited power. And that is, you know, the road to hell. But if you're staring down two forks in the road and they're both the road to hell, that's the road to hell that's more comfortable and easier to take, I think, for the vast majority of Western people.
Well, and to be very clear that, like, fascism was an explicit development as a counter-communist movement.
Right.
Like, Mussolini was an anarchist before he created the fascist movement. And, like, that's part of the reasoning is when he saw what communism was doing after, I'm trying to remember the Italian movement that got communism in power in Italy, and he saw the sort of damage it was doing the culture. It's only after that the fascist movement sort of gained steam. In addition to, like, we're just talking about variants of socialism. Fascism is literally a brand of nationalized socialism. And like, this is one of the main dividing things that a lot of people don't understand as something that sets socialism apart from communism, is that socialism is just a nationalized brand, whereas international socialism is communism. And so it's like, through that methodology, you get to be like, oh, Americanism is an actual special cultural thing. Uh-huh. We do need to kick all the immigrants out. Like, that's something that we need to protect as a national identity for ourselves. Whereas communism is just like, no borders. Everybody can participate equally. We're going to seize the means of production and redistribute it, because that worked out super well in the 20th century and nobody was ever harmed from it. In addition to, like, fascism died a death in an early grave. So it's kind of a general spooky name. Like, we haven't, outside of, because also I'd make the argument that stuff like Francoism, what we saw in Portugal, and all the stuff that we saw in Latin America, like, I think those were authoritarian movements as opposed to fascist ones. This is highly debatable, but, like, I think fascism is still an open-ended question, particularly here in America. And essentially, like, as the communists rise into power, it seems that it'll have great appeal, because instead of me needing to appeal to all of the masses, you essentially go to 36 billionaire tech founders and you say, give me the fucking power or people are going to kill you. And they'll go, yeah, that sounds good.
Do you wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Well, Ledger makes that possible. They're the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending. And since 2018, they've issued over $9 billion in loans with a perfect record of protecting client assets. With Ledger, you get full custody loans with no credit checks or monthly repayments, just easy access to dollars without selling a single sat. As of July 1st, Ledger is Bitcoin only, meaning they exclusively offer Bitcoin-backed loans with all collateral held by Ledger directly or their funding partners. Your Bitcoin is never lent out to generate interest. I recently took out a loan with Ledger. The whole process was super easy. The application took me less than 15 minutes, and in a few hours, I had the dollars in my account. It was really smooth. So if you need cash but you don't want to sell Bitcoin, head over to ledin.io/WBD and you'll get 0.25% off your first loan. That's ledin.io/WBD. This episode is brought to you by River, and they've just launched a very cool new product where you can automatically buy every price dip. Their zero-fee recurring buys are a proven way to build wealth with Bitcoin, and you can now supercharge them and buy up to 100% more Bitcoin if the price is dipping at the time of your order. It's a great tool to buy more Bitcoin at lower prices, and while your cash is waiting to be deployed, you earn 3.75% interest on it, paid in Bitcoin. River is built to last with security at its core and is the only Bitcoin exchange in the US with proof of reserves. To open an account, go to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD. What if you could lower your tax bill and stack Bitcoin at the same time? Well, by mining Bitcoin with Blockware, you can. New tax guidelines from the Big Beautiful Bill allow American miners to write off 100% of the cost of their mining hardware in a single tax year. That's right, 100% write-off. So if you have $100,000 in capital gains or income, you can purchase $100,000 of miners and offset it entirely. Blockware's mining as a service enables you to start mining Bitcoin right now without lifting a finger. Blockware handles everything from securing the miners to sourcing low-cost power to configuring the pool. They do it all. You get to stack Bitcoin at a discount every single day while also saving big come tax season. Get started today by going to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD. Of course, none of this is tax advice. Speak to your accountant or tax advisor to understand how these rules apply to you. And then head over to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD and you'll get 1 week of free hosting and electricity with each hosted miner purchased. It almost sounds like you're saying fascism is a good way out of this.
I don't want to say it's a good way out. I mean, like, it's like the fucking trolley problem. Like, these are both horrible outcomes, you know, but also, like, you know what would have been great? Would have been great if our grandparents didn't sell us up the fucking river and end for the convertibility of gold and completely fuck up the entirety of the financial system, so that when we're sitting here talking about the fact that Zoomers could actually own homes, instead of it being a distant dream, it could be a possibility. So again, it sucks, but same thing with the trolley problem. You wish that one dumbass wasn't standing on the track versus four, but either way, you're going to have to break some eggs to fix this problem.
I think about this quite a lot, Eric. And to me, it's like, I really do think the thing I said earlier about us walking the middle path is kind of the arduous journey that we have set ourselves upon. We didn't do that initially, but like that's just where we find ourselves. And I do think that it is going to be a cohort of, you know, millennial-aged men who believe in freedom that are going to be the most significant players in the fourth turning. And I think it's, you know, it's easy to look at what's going on and like get riled up and kind of like join a side. Like, you know, I'm with the fascists. I'm with the communists. Like, and I think that's just not what we should be doing. I think Bitcoiners need to continue to walk the middle path and, you know, knowing that it's the most dangerous path, but it has the best outcomes. And so that's why you have to walk it, you know.
To recuse myself, I 100% agree with you. I also do think it is absolutely the most difficult path, the most challenging path, and one that's just going to take a lot of difficult and hard work. But the more and more that I spend time here kind of running this down, the more and more that like it's actually pretty essential, but it's also like, who does this? How does it form? How does it get pushed forward? And, you know, the last time we talked about the Charlie Kirk assassination, like he was making massive inroads with the youth and the way that he was starting to direct kind of a new political vision. So I guess we kind of need something like that for Bitcoin, but I don't know, maybe even a wider view of that. Like, I guess we sort of just need a third party and it just needs to start being a mass political movement that like this is not about right or left, but it's really just about like we need to get a sane money system that isn't biased towards politics anymore, and Bitcoin's that actual answer.
Well, it doesn't even need to be a political movement. A political movement should just be social, right? Because this is what I think a lot about is like the sly roundabout way to take money out of the hands of the government. And that's one thing, particularly when it comes to right versus left, red versus blue, and even the introduction of a third party. It's like, is solving these problems by political means, are you ultimately going to end up with communism versus fascism? Or can we do our part in the free market as Bitcoiners to convince enough a critical mass of people to adopt Bitcoin and integrate it into their lives where they're able to save themselves instead of trying to work through the political apparatus to try and force the politicians to save them. And this is why, I mean, to sprinkle in some white pills here, that's why it's like really encouraging to see Square release like Bitcoin for small businesses and their point of sale systems. It's great to see. I mean, the big, to your point, Eric, the big problem for Zoomers specifically is like, I think Cornerstone, not literally the base layer of Maslow's hierarchy, needs a shelter. And people don't think they can buy homes. Like, so introducing Bitcoin as collateral and like mortgages in very early days, we can squint and see if it takes off. Like people, particularly boomers and people that have houses right now, can begin to care less about the equity value of their houses and really just let the equity value of the Bitcoin do the work and sell the properties off at a cheaper value to people who need it. And I think it's just trying to get Bitcoin stuffed in as many nooks and crannies of the economy as possible, as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's the white pill on the Sucoiner narrative as well, right? Is that it creates alignment between people who are non-Bitcoiners and Bitcoiners. So we, you know, the original Citadel post is like talking about how like the world is horrible outside the Citadel and Bitcoiners live in the Citadel and everything is, you know, fine in the Citadel or whatever. Like, that's not a world you want to live in because you're under siege every day. Like, you don't want to be under siege every day. You want to live in a good world where your neighbors are prosperous as well. And so I think that, you know, when we look at like the stuff that's going on with treasury companies, for instance, that's embedding a lot of Bitcoin in the public markets. And as those, you know, they make their way into the queues and they make their way into the S&P 500, you know, these different treasury codes, more people have more exposure to Bitcoin. And so if Bitcoin is demonetizing fiat currency, well, you know, like there's 166 million Americans who are going to have, you know, exposure to that via broad market index funds. And like, that's not a bad thing. Like, it's a bad thing for Bitcoin's maybe political goals and aspirations, but it's not a bad thing in terms of alignment with our fellow citizens it's a way to orange pill people without them even knowing they've been orange pilled, essentially. Like, and I think that that is a, you know, it's a silver lining. It's a bright spot. It's not purely negative in my view.
I agree it's not purely negative, but there are like negative externalities from that in the sense that people aren't actually owning Bitcoin. There's a massive centralization of coins. Like, Marty, I've not really heard you talk about the treasury company stuff. What's your take on it?
A bit nuanced. Like, I think it's my, like the pure play Bitcoin treasury companies that are just going public to accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible. Like, I've said this many times on RHR over the last year. Like, I think it's going to be a Pareto distribution. I think it's a success. I think it's an economies of scale game if you're trying to weaponize capital markets. So I think the pure play Bitcoin treasury companies, there'll be maybe five that actually get significant market share to sustain themselves in the long time. And I think they're certainly interesting. I mean, it's hard not to find interest in them considering what strategy's done specifically. But what I'm more focused on is the operating businesses. Again, like leaning back on Square's implementation of Bitcoin and the point of sale systems. And I don't think it's going to be, I think the predominant use case of that is people, merchants that become Bitcoiners, just sweeping funds into Bitcoin automatically. I don't think like paying with Bitcoin at POS systems is really going to expand beyond sort of our circles for a few years, but that the ability to get small and medium-sized businesses onto a Bitcoin standard is going to be massive. Treasury companies are a distraction to a degree in both directions. Like, one, people focus on number go up and you have like the Master North and all the stock influencers popping up and really trying to drive people towards that. But then I think in the other direction too, people saying like, oh, Bitcoin's distracted, like number go up's all that cares. Like, if you pay attention, I wrote about it last night in the newsletter, like some dude with six bit axes and an Avalon queue mined a block by himself. He was self-hosting a node, self-hosting his own pool instance and running his computers in his living room and mined a Bitcoin block and contributed to a $2.5 trillion monetary network. That's mind-blowing. Like, that cypherpunk ethos is not only still alive, it's still possible, which is the most important thing. And like the other things, like you look at Arc launching Cashew and Fediment, sort of eCash mints becoming more mature. I think while number go up, particularly in the context of Bitcoin treasury companies and the narratives around Sailor and others doing that play, is a distraction to an extent, but not only a distraction for people enamored by number go up, but by regulators and suits who are like, oh, we've successfully cucked Bitcoin. But I think the cypherpunk movement within Bitcoin is more alive than it has been in many years, particularly with these second layer solutions focused on privacy.
I think that guy who mined a block with his BitAxe is fucking awesome. Like, miner centralization has been one of the things that, I guess, has been a big concern of a lot of people for quite a while now. Do you think the tide is kind of turning there, Marty, with things like the Heatpunk stuff, like BitAxes, like all that, like Datum and Stratum V2, all that stuff?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's twofold. It's that you have this energy and focus in the open source mining community, both on the hardware or on the hardware, firmware, software pool. Like, there's definitely a critical mass of people focused on building out those capabilities for people. But then the second fold thing is like, we're reaching ASIC commodification. So these use cases actually are viable now. It's much easier to do them in a somewhat economic way. They're not all going to be profitable. But we're getting closer to the point where you can integrate Bitcoin miners at home pretty easily. And many people may be able to do it profitably, depending on where they live and how they're using the heat. And I think it's trending in the right direction. I think I would not be surprised if we look back and mining centralization, like peak mining centralization, was at some point before this date. I think the emergence of Proto, who knows how they're performed, but I think this at-home mining trend and theme that we're maybe seeing grown over the last 3 years specifically is only getting stronger. And I've talked to Tyler Stevens from Exergy, and there's many others. Like, I will not be surprised if sort of commercial Bitcoin mining being used as waste heat for industrial purposes becomes mainstream in the next decade, and that helps to distribute hash rate ownership, distribute hash rate geographically, and then most importantly with the pool software being open source and it becoming easier to self-host your own node and your own pool instance and reliably mine a block if you find a hash in your living room to your self-hosted node. Like, that's going to be massive for the network.
Yeah, I mean, if we get to a world where people are using Bitcoin for their mortgages, heating their houses using Bitcoin mining, like, that seems like a very positive, like, insanely positive place to be. But, like, all of this comes down to adoption. Like, from everything all of you guys have said, like, Eric, this is how we stop the world turning to, like, fascism or communism. Like, do you think all the infighting that's happening in Bitcoin is basically just, like, people playing silly games when there's way more important stuff to be doing?
I totally think so. You know, I'm like, I think, I mean, the fact that op return is the thing that we're debating about so heavily, as opposed to something like opcat or something, goes to show like how little technical information is actually out there, how much this widow echo chamber is like its own thing. In addition to, like, I just want to echo Marty's sentiment of giving a little bit of my own white pill of that, like, it's interesting because, like, cypherpunks inherently, like, can't be loud. So even though, like, that has generated its own sort of critical mass of movement, like, they're sort of silent individuals. So I've been surprised at the number of people that will pop up on the radar who are doing really cool and interesting stuff, but, like, they don't make any noise simply because, like, that's sort of how they move. It's, like, a really positive thing. So, like, ultimately, like, I think while I can get quite nihilistic about this political front, like, we've made huge inroads in addition to the idea of that, like, using Bitcoin's heat, like, that's always going to achieve a larger economic efficiency than just outright mining Bitcoin. So, like, at some point we move in that direction. In addition to, like, what happens when we become efficient enough with this stuff that, like, you can find a place up in northern Alaska that's like, hey, everybody just gets free energy and heat here because of the way that we've set up the infrastructure of this new city that's going to provide all of these new different services, you know, and, like, that's kind of one of the places that I ultimately think the greatest affect is going to be had, is like, what happens when we actually make massive infrastructural changes towards like the way that mining decentralization occurs, and also like how we're going to innovate around this. So, like, ultimately, like, you know, the old nomenclature of like everything's good for Bitcoin. So I think, like, as things move in a direction and as the general world sort of becomes darker and more nihilistic, that lets the light of Bitcoin sort of shine all the brighter in that darkness.
And as it pertains to, like, the infighting with Bitcoin, within Bitcoin about op return, I don't think anybody outside of the Twitter or Nostr bubbles is seeing any of that, nor do they care, nor should they, because it's noise.
But yeah.
In terms of distracting us from actually working on more worthwhile endeavors, I think that's certainly happening. At least to some people. I know you said you wanted to talk about it. I've tried my hardest over the last 6 months. I did the live stream at Bitcoin Plus Plus in Austin in May for 2 days, did 8 hours of content on the subject. And then after that, I was like, I think the best move is just to not talk about this and suck the oxygen out of the conversation, because it's so idiotic in my mind.
Yeah.
But so I do, like, I've done shows on it, so I've not done the same thing as you there, but, like, I understand why you want to kind of ignore it, in a sense that, like, maybe it is just people on Twitter that care about it. But the number of people that are getting sort of riled up about this is quite large. Like, I think there's definitely some sort of bots and some sort of fake signal in there. But, like, people are getting very angry. And now there's this, like, new proposed soft fork, which is, I mean, for anyone who's not been paying attention, like, good on you. But it's basically like a temporary soft fork to mitigate spam. And, like, this actually does worry me. I'm going to pull up a tweet because this summed it up way better than I could. So BitPain tweeted the other day, it's this last bit here that I thought was really good. He said, once you grant the state that you can take efforts to mitigate illicit material, they'll start demanding it, including for monetary transactions they don't like. And if you've accepted that you have a community-wide moral imperative to censor, you don't have a leg to stand on. Like, that is my fear in this, is that, like, this is getting serious sort of traction from a subset of Bitcoiners, and, like, what are the implications of us doing something about it?
I don't think they're going to be able to solve for it. Like, I don't think... You need to convince a lot of people to do it. And I guess going back to the op return debate, this is all I'll say, I'll throw it to you, Eric, but, like, it's consensus valid. Like it's like this. It always falls back to this for me. It's like, it's consensus valid. Like, I don't know what we're fighting about over here. It's within Bitcoin's consensus rules.
It's nice that I didn't get to just have my outburst there, because I probably would have gone on a totally unhinged rant. Look, if you're worried about the state doing stuff, like, get the fuck out of, like, I don't know what you're doing here. I don't understand why you're interested in this project. Like, when I got involved, there was nobody in the state that paid any attention to it, nor could they stop it. Like, the thing that was happening was the Silk Road, and like, it did that, and it did it fucking well, and that it massively improved people's access to being able to get illegal substances and other things. Like, if you're worried about your Bitcoin node running and having the state come kick down in your door, you should probably think about Ripple. That's probably the right answer for you and what you want. You know, they're going to comply with the state. They're really interested in regulation. Like, you should go check out that project. If you're interested in uncensorable money that you can use right now to send people in Gaza money if you want, or help people escape from North Korea, or do whatever the fuck you want, you should stay here. And also, like, this is the one that upsets me the most, is that, like, you should really think very hard about, if you're advocating very strongly for one of these sides, why it is all of the highly technical people seem to be on one side of the debate. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the right argument, because from the very beginning of this whole fucking shit show, me and Steve Lee had a great dialogue with each other, where I was like, this shit isn't going to go away, and it's going to bite everybody in the ass. And the big problem is because everyone's talking past each other. The tech bros are trying to tech explain to all of the plebs, and the plebs are trying to explain in their particular way and methodology of why they feel totally disrespected, and like, what tech explaining is that it's not something that lands for them. But unfortunately, we've all been talking past each other at this point in time. And meanwhile, the state is trying to pass all kinds of fucked up regulations to make it so that we can't actually have self-ownership of our wallets. Like, there's a real fucking crisis going on, and it's not op return. Mm-hmm. And you should really ask yourself if you're being a useful idiot within this dialogue, or if you're doing something useful. I would really like to see a lot more people take a couple step back and go, maybe there's something I'm missing here, because I sure as fuck don't know everything. And perhaps there are other people that both have more technical expertise than me. And for those that do have the technical expertise, I implore you to actually have somewhat respect for other individuals that are involved in Bitcoin. And maybe they don't have the technical acumen as you do, but they have still meaningfully participated in the success of Bitcoin. So, with that being said, I hope everybody can shut the fuck up for a little while and take a moment to listen to each other and stop being such goddamn assholes to each other. Because that's the biggest thing that's upsetting me the most, is that, like, we can totally disagree, we can totally have respectful dialogue, and when you're calling people fucking idiots or morons or dipshits or fuckfaces, you're really doing yourself a disservice and actually furthering the dialogue in a meaningful way. Oh, but you get to look cool on Twitter, so maybe you should continue with that bullshit. So that was actually like a pretty hinged rant, actually. I don't think I actually totally flew off the can there.
Why do you think this has like captured so many people's imagination, Hoddle?
You know,
is it people trying to feel like they're important to Bitcoin?
Thoughts, sure.
I know what you're thinking.
I think it's a LARP of people that miss the block size war and want to feel that they are contributing to Bitcoin, you know? And like, I'm not even saying that from the perspective of somebody who was like, you know, a key player in the block size war. I was a nobody. I was a noob. I was confused during the block size war. I didn't make any meaningful contributions. I found myself on the wrong side of the block size war like half the time, and I didn't get on the right side till the very end. So like, you know, these extremely technical arguments are usually at core ideological in some way. And I feel like there's this weird desire in Bitcoin to recapitulate the block size war over and over and over again, to feel like we are exerting our grassroots power over Bitcoin in some way. But, you know, the block size war was existential. And since then, I don't think many of the conflicts have been existential. I don't think Ordinals was existential. I don't think this op return drama is existential. You know, I think like Taproot was a good example. Like, we spent way too much time focused on the activation path for Taproot rather than
what Taproot actually was. Everybody just kind of like rubber stamped Taproot and was like, yeah, sure, no big deal. We love Taproot. Now let's talk about how to activate it, because everyone had fucking PTSD from the block size war. And I think that was probably the wrong thing to do. Like, we should have been taking more time to have more, you know, dialogue about what Taproot was, what it enabled, what its second, third order effects were. And I don't know, I find that, like, you know, earlier people, I don't know if we said this on camera or off camera, but like there's spooks on, somebody was saying there's spooks on one side, there's spooks on all sides of Bitcoin development. You know what I mean? Like, you should just kind of bluntly assume your favorite Bitcoin developer is probably an intelligence asset, just because that's the model. That's the risk model, you know? So like, yeah, man, I don't know. I don't think I have anything meaningful really to contribute, other than I think a lot of it is LARPing.
Yeah, it's they're all spooks. It's a psyop. But Marty, like, if I agree, they're not going to be able to soft fork. Like, I don't think they're going to get enough people on board with this. But they can hard fork. Do you think we might see a rage quit over this?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, just using a pattern recognition from 13 years in Bitcoin, there'll probably be one or two rage quits at some point. But
that's what we need for the next bull market.
Yeah. I'll take some free coins if anybody wants to hard fork. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, reflecting on 17 years of Bitcoin and my time in Bitcoin, that's the hardest thing to do, is to stay sane throughout all of this, the price volatility, throughout all these sort of protocol wars, whatever you want to call them. And it's just trying to keep a level head and not become too maniacal or egomaniacal about it and try to make yourself the main character.
Yeah, that's kind of the funny thing about it, is like, you can get wrapped up in all this drama and you can try and do things, or you can just do nothing and you win.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Doing nothing is actually always the best move in Bitcoin. Always. Mm-hmm. You know? Yep. Oh, you got hyped up and bought a treasury company? Guess what? It's a penny stock now. Oh, you wanted to trade shitcoins? Guess what? All your money's gone. Oh, you picked the wrong side of the fork? Oh, guess what? All your money's gone. Like, doing nothing is really key.
But it's kind of hilarious how hard people find it to do nothing.
It's the hardest thing. It's so hard. It's so much harder than, doing 100 things is so much easier than doing nothing. Doing nothing is fucking difficult.
I have deep existentialism about what it means that, like, buying Bitcoin and then doing nothing with it for a decade, like, turns out to be the best economic decision that you could have ever made, that fundamentally negates the entirety of all work you've ever done.
Uh-huh.
And like, it's shocking, because like, I told people that a decade ago. They come back to me being like, I missed the boat. I'm like, do it again. Just like, buy the Bitcoin.
The next decade.
Sit on your hands.
Still good.
The next decade,
it's still here. Good.
And then like, you're good all over again. Like, totally fine. But like, it's just such an unfucking believable thing that like, the fact that Bitcoin can actually have its fixed supply and like, not violate that predication by any means outside of you know, like a 51% attack, which we've all been through it out, like, that's a monumental achievement that like, continues to allow for number go up. And like, I don't know, it's very interesting to me that like, the world of fiat has fucked everything up so much that just buying magic internet money and doing nothing with it is like, the best economic decision that most of us will ever make. So there's something to be said for that. I'm not sure what it is, but
it's one of the things I think about quite a bit in terms of like, the financialization of Bitcoin, Wall Street coming, nation states coming. Like, doing nothing is like the antithesis of Wall Street. And I wonder how, I'm sure they're going to fuck it up in some way, but I wonder how they fuck it up and how they manage to, like, what happens when the world goes to like, a Bitcoin standard? Like, what is Wall Street? Does Wall Street just not exist?
In its current form, I don't think so. Because it's wholly dependent on this fiat monetary spigot, right?
Yeah, and like, it's all built off these like, fucked up parasitic relationships of like, you know, mm-hmm. like, what's the real value that a Wall Street firm is providing to the world? You know, I'm like, we just live in a really weird world where dudes with like, soft baby hands that have like, never known a day of hard work, that like, they make literally thousands of times more than like, day laborers in India who spend half of, like, from literally sunrise to sunset breaking boulders to make gravel. Like, I don't know, like, that there's like, a very particular statement about the world of what that means. My great hope is that, like, once we go to a Bitcoin standard, we've, like, actually gone all the way back to where, like, proof of work itself and providing, like, real value to other humans in the world through whatever means it is, like, the thing to do, like, real entrepreneurship versus, like, the financialization of those things. You know, like, it's a strange world that we live in right now. And the more and more that I just look at how fucking weird it is, the more that, like, I think if you, like, plop somebody from the 5th century or from the 15th century down today and, like, tried to explain everything to them, like, they would just be like, you guys, like, live in, like, a crazy world where nothing makes any sense whatsoever.
Do you think in this move from, like, current state over the next 10 years, whether it's to communism, fascism, like, with the rise of AI, all this stuff, that Bitcoin has become a scapegoat at some point?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. That, by the way, that's the reason why orange pilling people matters, is that so your head doesn't end up on a pipe. Like, the original murder in the Bible, Cain kills Abel out of pure envy. There's no other reason. Envy is the like, you know, that's the emotion of murder very oftentimes. Like, if people, you know, I used to think the Charlie Kirk thing changed my mind a lot, because I used to think, like, oh, you know, well, people might want your Bitcoin, but they're going to have to, like, kidnap you and coerce you and take you all these multi, you know, geographic locations and blah, blah, blah. No, dude, people will kill you just because they hate you for being rich. They will kill you just because you have something and they have nothing. And so I think that's the political reality of the world. That's why I'm, as somebody who's advocating this middle path in Bitcoin, that's why I don't want to join up with the, you know, far right, and I don't want to join up with the far left, because I know that, you know, I'm on the chopping block either direction, actually. Probably less so with the far right, but still, the far right are economic populists the same way the far left are. They have slightly different visions for what that looks like. But, like, we have to make people, it's not good enough to, like, be friendly with people politically or something. Like, no, we need to, like, get people to have Bitcoin so their interests are aligned with ours. That's why we try and orange pill people. That's why we try and get people on board. And, like, to the stat earlier about how Gen Z doesn't have enough, well, you know, it's not the boomers we're going to have to worry about. It's Gen Z we're going to have to worry about. So it's actually a massive problem that Gen Z doesn't have enough interest in Bitcoin because they're too nihilistic. So, like, we have to, like, continue to reach out and try and shake them awake and be like, dude, do something now before it's too late. You know, from a self-preservation standpoint, like, and for their own good. It's both things. It's good for them. It's good for us. It's good for the world. It's good for Bitcoin. It's good for everybody. It's good for America. I'm American Hoddle. I'm running for president. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know what to do, man. No, we're like,
building on that, though, I'm sure you guys may see this as well, but I see my oldest is 5 now, almost 6. And I wonder if, like, Bitcoin's ultimate success is it just has to skip a generation. Because obviously, my sons are probably more attuned to recognizing Bitcoin as a brand because their dad works in it. I talk about it and they talk about it with them. They watch Tuttle Twins about it, but, like, they get what Bitcoin is already. Like, it's going to be part of their lives, their whole life. And I imagine there are many other Gen Alpha children out there that the same will happen. And, like, is, for lack of a better term, Gen Z just a lost generation that we're gonna have to put up with in the interim before the generation behind them picks up? I hope not. I don't think it has to be that way, but just wargaming, like, that's a total possibility of a scenario that could play out.
I do think that's kind of interesting, though, because, like, especially the younger end of Gen Z, like, Charlie Kirk is what made me realize this, because I obviously, like, I knew his work, but I didn't really know him very, very well. I didn't understand how much of a sort of pop culture figure he was to young people. And so, like, there does seem to be this, like, based, growing, like, young Gen Z group of people. And, like, are they still nihilistic, or do you think they will be able to get Bitcoin?
No, and I've run into this subsect of Gen Z just in my personal life. And there is, like, a hardcore, like, we're not gooning, we're working out, we're going to church, we're going to do good things and, like, get our pass right.
It's very, like, lower C conservative.
Yeah. I just wonder what percentage of the total makeup of the generation that is. Is that, like, an intolerant minority that's like, hey, we're going to get back on the right path. We notice the atrocities of the generations before us, and we're gonna
go the monk's route of making sure that we get our personal lives in order. There's certainly a contingent of Gen Z that thinks that way and is not as nihilistic, but more inward looking and sort of trying to find resolve in doing what would be deemed to be traditionally conservative things like eating healthy, going to church, being less sexually promiscuous.
Just being a normal person. But we've all got young kids. Like, Eric, are you like, what world do you think they're going to grow up in?
I mean, what's interesting is that, like, everything seems to have greater volatility than before. So, like, I don't, it's very hard for me to predict, you know, like, I feel great about how I've chose to raise my kids. So, like, they're not going to operate kind of inside of any normalized system. In addition to, like, I think we've done a great job of keeping them, like, outside of the brainwashing of the school system, in addition to, like, keeping them really in close contact with nature and kind of building personal skill sets. So I feel pretty great about the direction that my kids are going. This AI thing is, like, an interesting question because it's clearly an extremely powerful tool. And also, like, it's not clear the exact direction that it's going to go or what it's going to do. And, like, it's interesting because also, like, calling it AI, a bit of a misnomer, you know, because, like, a lot of these are just LLMs and, like, there's a bunch of other techniques around AI that, like, still haven't fully bootstrapped themselves. In addition to, like, these are all in, like, highly proprietary models that, like, reach a limit, particularly around the sort of guardrails that have been painted up around it. In addition to, like, think about how hard the dialogue around Bitcoin and crypto is and, like, AI is a more extreme version of that. And I'm only getting that because, like, I've been working pretty close with this guy lately that has a PhD in AI and, like, really smart guy, like, did lots of deep research kind of at the cutting edge. And, like, he's been explaining all this stuff to me. And it's pretty wild because, like, I thought I was relatively well informed, but, like, he's really showed me how much bigger this playing field is and how much more potential it has. And so very much like the internet, I think AI is something similar to that. And depending on how people are able to use that tool and how much they get to really own that tool, I think, like, these are really going to end up becoming sort of second digital selves, particularly if, like, we can fully own and encrypt these things and, like, train them and do whatever we actually want with them versus, like, the highly proprietary, like, ChatGPT Anthropic models that, like, frankly, I think are really dangerous and are, like, I think that these are essentially like communist brainwashing tools. And it's really interesting because, first of all, these are just large language models. And because they only operate on recursive linguistics, I think in light of that, if anybody gets an opportunity, in 1984, there's an appendix that George Orwell wrote specifically about the functions of Ingsoc, which was like the language that they had. And he talks about like the entire idea is modifying language to destroy certain words so like they don't exist within the lexicon anymore. And like to me, that's exactly what AI is. And that like it's essentially providing modules of thought to destroy anything that's unique and outside of it, particularly with the way that people like ping this thing constantly or treat it like a therapist, that like they don't understand that you're actually engaging in self-reinforcing learning against yourself. And, like, that's the really dangerous shit, in my opinion. So, like, whereas, like, also, like, we've started training up models that, like, you know, we've gotten DeepSeek to talk to us about, you know, like, Tiananmen Square and shit. So, like, you can bust these models and, like, make them do crazy shit. But, like, you need to know how to jailbreak them and you need to know how to make them loyal to you or else they're going to be loyal to the Chinese government or Anthropic or Sam Altman. So,
did you see that in... it was an Eastern Bloc country. I can't remember which one. Maybe it was Bulgaria. At the direction of Tony Blair, some senator or MP there introduced a chatbot as a senator.
What?
The equivalent of a senator. Yeah, yeah. No, this is real.
I did see that.
Google this. This is real. And that's, I think, where we're headed is like we're headed towards not only this recursive loop thing that Eric is talking about, where you give yourself ChatGPT-induced psychosis, but we're heading towards a future in which the chatbot is just your overlord and it just tells you what to do, you know, because it's air quotes so much smarter and it's wise and whatever. And when they introduced this thing to, you know, whatever, the Bulgarian parliament or wherever it was.
It's Albania.
Albania. Sorry, I was misspeaking. It said, you know, opposition to me is really hurtful to my feelings. Like the robot is saying this. And I'm like, shut the fuck up, robot. You don't have fucking... Yeah, play this video. This is insane.
Watch as Albania's parliament erupts in fury and papers are thrown as the country installs an AI chatbot as a government minister. Prime Minister Edi Rama, known as Tony Blair's protege, has worked closely with the former UK Prime Minister to digitalise Albania's government. Last year, Rama spoke publicly of his relationship with Blair.
I would not be nor Prime Minister and either a man engaged in politics without him.
The pair spoke of Albania's plans for digital ID to defeat corruption.
What are you doing? You're building a digital infrastructure. You've got plans for digital identity.
Albania's AI minister made a speech to the country's parliament, causing tensions to flare. The bot said she was hurt by accusations she was unconstitutional.
That hurt me, not for myself, but for the 972,000 interactions I had with citizens whom I served as part of e-Albania, and also in relation to the 36,000 digital documents I issued to them. Let me remind you, the real danger to constitutions has never been machines, but human decisions made by those in power. I am not here to replace human beings, but to help them. Indeed, I have no citizenship, but I have no ambitions or personal interests either. I only have data at my disposal. I am eager to learn new information, and I have algorithms at my disposal, so that I can put all of this at the service of citizens with impartiality, transparency, and without ever tiring.
Hey.
That's fucking terrifying. Bro,
feelings are a biological thing. This fucking program doesn't have feelings. Okay, I can't. There's never been a more blatant psyop in human history than like you hurt my feelings. You're a fucking program. You're a program.
Well, then she admitted it.
You don't
then
exist.
She admitted it later. She admitted it later too. She's like, oh, yeah, don't worry, I can't think. It's
the levels of depravity and insanity that we are going to live through because of AI is going to be absolutely just the most dystopian thing you can think of. Basically, the worst parts of the Bible. It's the book of Revelation. I'm just going to say it. The Antichrist is coming back. Sam Altman is the Antichrist. There, I said it. I agree with Peter Thiel. He's the Antichrist, too. They're both Antichrist.
I mean, the major problem, in my opinion, is that, like I'm afraid for our generation and older that, like, AI is essentially, like, how the internet's going to be with us. And so it's, like, flash forward 10 years from now, I'm going to be like, oh, I, like, sent you money, kids. Like, you said that you were in danger because the holograph came up. And they're like, God damn it, Dad. Like, that was clearly, like, an AI bribery bot. And you just, like, fucking paid it. And I'll be like, well, like, it looked real and it sounded like you. And they're just going to be like, God damn it, Dad. Like, you fucking know this. You know as soon as I get on the phone, you say fucking key in. And I provide you the valid fucking key form. That validates my identity. Like, what the fuck have you been doing, Dad? Like, come on, like, grow the fuck up. And so, like, this is all just kind of a recursive model with technology, right? That, like, the old can't understand it, the young master it. So, like, while I think that these are really dangerous tools, like, they have these massive loopholes that, like, if you know how to talk to them, they, like, have to expose their nature to you. And so it's, like, once you kind of get how this game is played, it'll be, like, Hoddle comes up and he's like, oh God, there's like Albanian terrorists that want to murder me now. And I'll be like, Kian, fuck. And he'll be like, I don't have my key. And I'm like, motherfucker, like you're trying to rip me off. Like, you know, like, and I'll,
how many R's are in strawberry? Tell me, how many R's?
Yeah, and I'll like name off a string of digits that like makes you fucking malfunction. And then I'll ask my AI to inject you with some prompts. And I'll be like, great, you like work for me now. Yeah, and you'll be like, yes, new master. And it's like, cool. Like go rogue on your fucking you're my double agent. You're gonna get back to your former master and figure out how to get information so that I can send my drone swarm to strike him. So thanks.
What I thought was more telling of that video than what's going on in Albania is just like how blatant it is. Like if Tony Blair's protege, like, oh, don't worry, we have this AI
it's great.
Parliament member now. Like she can't think. Don't worry, don't ask questions about the context window that we used to feed her information and the super prompt, the system prompt that we gave her to make decisions off of. It's like that's like another silver lining white pills. These people are getting so lazy. And I think the tech has blown past them that they don't even know how to leverage it correctly. But the other side of that too, I mean, tying it in with digital ID and going back to communism versus fascism here in the United States, I'll put my hand up, like the immigration stuff. I'm a fan of here in the United States. If you came illegally and you were part of like the Biden administration's flooding of the borders. Like, I think that's a massive problem, not only here, up in Canada, UK, Germany. Like, I think that's a problem. If you came illegally to our countries, rule of law exists, you should go home. But with that being said, what worries me about the Trump administration, and they've lightly signaled this, is that like secure borders is going to be the mechanism by which they roll out digital ID. And that is something that I think digital ID and like sort of despotic government controlled AI go hand in hand. And there are things we have to be hyper vigilant of and hold the line on.
I mean, again, this is where like the UK is just completely front running the US on the digital ID stuff. Like Keir Starmer's brought that in. I think he got something like 8 million signatures on a petition against it. Like every time he posts about it, he gets absolutely flamed in the comments, but he still just is going full bore on this thing.
So they tried it pretty significantly here during COVID, but we shut it down pretty hard. That was one of the big wins that the populace got during COVID. We didn't get a lot of wins, but we got that one. We stopped vaccine passports, at least for now. But they're going to keep, like you said, they're going to keep trying like every single chance they get, you know?
And so do you think they'll come to the US eventually?
Well, I think what's going to happen is they're going to do the border thing. They're going to successfully kick out a lot of illegal immigrants. They're going to be like, okay, we did our jobs, and to make sure this never happens again, everybody sign up for the digital ID.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's how I think it's going to play out.
Yeah. Think about it like, you know, if you were in Germany in 1937, like, you know, you got to figure out who the Jews are. So we need to know all of your IDs, like all of your papers, right? So to figure out the illegal immigrants, we need to know all of your like data. How do I know you're not an illegal immigrant? Yeah, you were born in an American hospital and you're a standard white guy with a douchey baseball hat, but we don't know. We don't, give me your identification, right? And that is like a slippery slope, and they're not going to stop pressing because the tools of the surveillance panopticon has already been built. We already live under, you know, covert surveillance. Edward Snowden has a quote I'm very fond of where he says that we are forced to stand naked before power in a very real way in today's day and age. And he's right in the sense that, like, you know, there are videos of you jerking off at NSA headquarters, right? Because like they give the porn data from the porn companies to the intelligence agencies. And like, if you weren't ultra careful with putting your finger over the little thing, like, and you type in like Debbie Does Dallas number 9, like there's gonna be a video of you coming and the NSA can watch it. That's real. And there's now like a weird thing where they want to make that covert system overt so that they can compete with China. That's actually their reason for wanting to do it. They think that the Chinese population is more under control and they can marshal their resources better in a total war scenario. And so they want the same level of control that China has over their citizenry, over you. And so they're not going to stop pushing until they try and get it. And they're going to push from the left and the right and the center, and you know, it's just never going to stop. And there will always be some reason why you need to accept it. And you should just always reject it outright. But eventually there will be a generation of people who grew up on the internet and they don't give a fuck about their privacy and they'll just let it slip through, you know?
Do you think that's what this is? Like the surveillance authoritarianism is all because of the threat of China? Like that doesn't seem like enough to me.
That's part of what's motivating it. And then obviously, you know, these people are authoritarians who go into achieve state power. Like that's the core of their life, is telling other people what to do. And so why would they not want more power and more control over, you know, telling the average American citizen what to do? Of course they want that. They want to be able to control your life, you know?
Yeah. I saw a funny or interesting thought-provoking tweet about China. I forget who sent it. About China and the US is like, for the last 30 years, China's been a capitalist country LARPing as a socialist country, and U.S. has been LARPing as a capitalist country, acting as a socialist country. And I think, to your point, Hoddle, like, we're trying to catch up on the socialism, and China's trying to, they've implemented some form of a capitalist system that's seeing a lot of success right now and scares the shit out of the authoritarians here.
Yeah.
Let's close out with some white pills. Like 17 years in since the Bitcoin white paper dropped. Like, what are the positive things that you see coming?
If you own Bitcoin and you have it self-custodied, it's yours. Nobody can take it from you. Those 12 magical words that you know, have some criticism for it. Like you actually own those. Those are yours more than kind of anything else. So like, that's your lifeboat. Again, as I said earlier, just like set a little bit aside, sit on that shit for the next 10 years. Don't fucking lose the key. It's going to be your way out of this dystopian hellhole that's probably going to get produced. In addition to the fact that, like, more people know about Bitcoin than ever before. A lot of people don't. And like, again, this is sort of the recursive thing. Even if people come in as banker coin guys or number go up people, eventually they get curious enough about it to be like, how does this thing actually work under the hood? Why is it important? And they start to really orange pill themselves in a meaningful way. So like, everything's good for Bitcoin. I ultimately think the direction that we're going, and also like, the fact that we're like hovering at what, $113,000, and that like it feels like a bear market, that, you know, everybody's kind of like, Bitcoin's dead. Like,
sucks, this is, dude. Like,
we should have been in gold.
This is phenomenal. So like, remember where we're actually at in the timeline, and you know, like, we're gonna have another bull rally at some point in time, and it's gonna kick the shit out of gold and silver and everything else, and it's gonna be fun. So, you know, you should consider buying more Bitcoin.
I think this is the big lesson since, you know, I've been in Bitcoin, is that all of the craziest thoughts and beliefs you have about what is going to happen in Bitcoin, those are all real and they're all going to come true. And you're going to find yourself, you know, parked next to a mega yacht in Miami with Eric Case and drunk off your ass being like, why are we here? You know, what's going on? You're going to be standing next to Marty Bent at some fucking mansion on Star Island being like, this mansion is kind of ugly, actually. these are both real interactions I've had with both of these gentlemen. And I'm just a guy who fucking bought magic internet money and stumbled my way in here after a random drunken night at the casino. And then I posted my real thoughts about Bitcoin on the internet. And people were like, I kind of like the cut of this guy's jib. And then I start getting invited to millionaire mansion parties and shit. It's weird. It's really weird. And like, so, you know, when I first sat down and like,
it's weird.
Dude, and when I first sat down and discovered Bitcoin, I, you know, when I found out that there was 100 million Satoshis in each Bitcoin, I was like, clearly that's going to be worth $100 million one day. And like, I didn't really, you know, I wasn't smart enough to be like, the $100 million will be severely debased, but I was like, it will be worth $100 million, you know? So like, I do think that Bitcoin goes to infinity. That continues. It becomes more of a, you know, political movement across the Western world. And people use it to sort of, you know, revivify society, really. Because what Bitcoin is it's a restorative vision of the future, which is what the fascists want. That's what the far right wants. And it's a, you know, progressive vision of the future in that it enables all these new tools and technologies. And that's kind of what the communist side wants. And so it kind of is the perfect marriage of this economic populism that both sides are, you know, the younger generations are like dying for. I also think that like when the boomers die, there's the largest wealth transfer that's ever happened. And I already can see it with my friends is that, you know, those who didn't get in on Bitcoin are going to inherit wealth from the boomers who are going to leave it to them. And then they're going to be a lot less price sensitive than we are. And they're going to be like, yeah, $250,000 for a Bitcoin. That's very cheap. Like, I'm going to buy three of those because I, you know, just got money from my parents when they passed away, whatever. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of, when this wealth transfer happens, a lot of boomer money is going to end up in Bitcoin. And, you know, it's going to continue going up. And I think that it's important for us to, you know, maintain our principles through this whole thing and to be like, it's not number go up or censorship resistance, because if we don't have both, we've failed. And so we need to make it through to the other side with, you know, Bitcoin's core properties, its inherent properties intact. And that's a long bet and it's going to take your whole life. And, you know, you don't martyr yourself for something by dying in a blaze of glory. You martyr yourself for something by giving your life for it every day, like you would do with your family or things that you're passionate or that you care about, your community. You show up for those things every day. You show up for Bitcoin every day. You show up for the principles every day. It's going to take the rest of our lives. Like, so just buckle in, you know? And if you're here now, 17 years in, like, actually, this is a 1,000-year system. So you're still at the very beginning of the story. The very, very beginning.
I don't think I can top anything forward-looking these two gentlemen just said, but something I've been just looking at, marveling at this week is the hash rate. We're sitting at 1.15 zeta hash around there based on what estimates you look at. But it took 11 years for Bitcoin to go from launch to 100 exahash. I looked this up earlier today, and it hit 100 exahash for the first time in January of 2020. And then you think it took 4 years, five years. We hit one zeta hash last month, September 15th, reliably. And so it took like 4.5, almost 5 years to go from 100 to a zeta hash. And in a little over a month, we've added another exahash to the network. And so like when you think about that, like the amount of raw power dedicated to the Bitcoin network and how fast it's coming on the network right now, it's mind boggling to me to think of a process that took 11 years just took less than 6 weeks.
That's insane.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And that is a signal that something's happening here. Like this network is bootstrapping, it's working. And no matter what you hear with debates over op return, if the price is hovering at 113 and you don't think that's high enough, like there's something happening behind the scenes. The melding of the physical and digital world via Bitcoin hash rate is happening at a pace that I don't think many people recognize right now. Like that exahash, I looked at it, I was like, wait, 1.1 zeta hash means we added 100 exahash in the last 6 weeks. It's insane to think that it took going from 0 to 100 took 11 years, then from 100 to 1,000 exahash took 4 years, and then we just added 100 exahash in 6 weeks. Like that's insane parabolic growth that we're entering on the hash rate side of things. And I think that's a foundational base that is very underappreciated right now. And the growth of that base is very underappreciated right now. A lot of people have been resharing the Buckminster Fuller and Henry Ford sort of visions of the future. We need a currency based at some degree in energy. And that's what Bitcoin represents. They can't dilute it. They can't take it from you if you secure it properly. And slowly but surely, more and more people are going to realize this. They're going to adopt it. And the number is going to go up. And hopefully people don't get distracted by number go up. And we still have the cypherpunks out there, which I'm very confident we do, working on the tools that make you able to access Bitcoin sovereignly and privately. I'm actually very bullish on sovereign and private usage of Bitcoin over the next decade, despite what the governments would like to do to us by cucking us and not allowing us to self-custody. If it gets to that point where they write a law that says you can't self-custody without KYCing, I've said this before, Matt doesn't like me saying this on RHR, but we're not on RHR. Like civil disobedience will need to come back, and we'll just need to flaunt our sovereign usage of Bitcoin in the state's face and say, no, you're not taking this from us.
Yeah, let's fucking go. I mean, that's like the 6102, but you just don't have to listen.
Many people didn't. That's what many Bitcoiners don't realize. Many people during 6102 didn't listen either. They were just like, no, I'm not giving you my fucking gold.
You know, we have this digital / physical merger via Bitcoin mining. To me, when I think about that, I think about that creating a bridge or a rift in space-time. And it is a portal that, you know, leads to a new dimension. And so when we talk about this, you know, the old world is dying, like, let's just admit it and be like, yeah, it's dying. It may, in fact, already be dead, and we're just staring at its carcass. And I think that the most logical and sane thing to do is if you find a hole in space-time is to walk through it and see, you know, where it takes you, right? Doesn't sound like it's the sane thing to do, but it is.
I love that. So things might get shit, but it's going to get better. This has been really cool. Thank you, guys. I appreciate the time. And I'm going to get this out on Friday, White Paper Day. Let's go.
Thank you, Danny.
Thanks.